Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Tuesday's hearings on California's Proposition 8 and the Defense of Marriage Act before the Supreme Court that some analysts suggest could be as divisive as the landmark abortion ruling Roe v. Wade, in the sense that legalizing same-sex marriage will likely have profound social implications that could plague our politics. Aziz Haque, a professor of law at the University of Chicago, who clerked on the Supreme Court for Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, joins us. Then we'll examine the deepening split in the Republican Party between those who want to be less ideological and more inclusive and those who believe that the party should be more ideologically conservative. Alan Lichtman, a distinguished professor of history at American University and author of White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, joins us to discuss the fate and future of the recent autopsy by the RNC that right-wing Republican activists have scorned. Then finally, we'll get an update on a country being torn apart from an expert on Syria, James Galvin, the author of The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. We will look into the implications of a rapprochement between Turkey and Israel and whether that portends some joint military action as concerns over a collapsing Assad regime with a large chemical weapons arsenal grows. Joining us now is Aziz Haque, who's a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk at the Supreme Court for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is the author of Unchecked and Unbalanced: Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aziz Haque.
Hi, Ian. Thank you for having me.
And what's your sense, then, of some of the analysts like Adam Liptak in the New York Times saying that the shadow of Roe v. Wade looms over this ruling on gay marriage that the hearings begin tomorrow in the Supreme Court?
I think that advocates of equality for people who are gay or lesbian or transgendered have always thought about Roe v. Wade and the perception that Roe v. Wade catalyzed a popular backlash against abortion rights in developing their strategy. And that's certainly been true with the litigation around marriage equality, and it's certainly going to be something that's in many people's minds tomorrow and Wednesday when the Supreme Court takes up in oral argument these cases. And I think the question that people might want to kind of use as the place to start their thinking about it is, was there really a backlash after Roe v. Wade?
Well, this backlash has already been brought up by the very judge who overturned Proposition 8, the federal judge Vaughn Walker in the Federal District Court in San Francisco. During closing arguments in the case, Judge Walker said that the Roe case has plagued our politics for 30 years because the Supreme Court had ultimately constitutionalized something that touches upon highly sensitive social issues. Isn't the danger, Judge Walker then asked the counsel for those who want to overturn Prop 8, Theodore Olson, who was challenging the ban, isn't it a danger not that you are going to lose this case either here at the Court of Appeals or at the Supreme Court, but that you might win?
The concern that Judge Walker raises is the concern that it actually conflates two different things. One is, it's a concern that change, if change happens too fast, produces countervailing, retrogressive movements. And second is the idea that if change is done by a court rather than by democratic bodies like Congress or state legislatures, then the mere fact that a decision is taken out of people's hands will lead to a backlash. And Roe v. Wade is kind of the poster child for these ideas. And the problem with using Roe v. Wade in the way that Judge Walker did, and Judge Walker ruled, by the way, eventually in favor of marriage equality in that case, the problem with invoking Roe v. Wade in that way is that it's not at all clear that that's what happened. A number of scholars have pointed out that there was, in fact, a great deal of resistance to abortion prior to the Supreme Court's opinion. And it's not as if the opinion itself, that when it was handed down, actually changes that much. Now, it is true that eventually Roe v. Wade gets taken up by people like Phyllis Schlafly on the right and becomes part of a broad political platform of the Republican Party and the right. But it's not clear that if Roe v. Wade hadn't happened, there wouldn't be something else that would have played something like the same role. So that we would have had a backlash against women's equality along gender lines, a backlash against reproductive freedom, all things that were going on in the 60s and early 70s anyway, regardless of what the Supreme Court did. We might have seen that backlash happening just with different placards, different signs, different slogans. And so the idea that Roe v. Wade played this really important role in the development of a reactionary movement against abortion, against reproductive freedoms, and against gender equality, I think it's really not clear that it did. And I think it's certainly not clear that today, were the Supreme Court to rule in favor of some kind of equality right with respect to marriage, and there's a whole slate of ways in which that might happen out of the cases that are being heard over the next couple of days, it's not really clear that we're going to see any kind of mobilization on the part of the conservative movement. Certainly possible that we might see it, but to predict the social consequences of a Supreme Court decision, I think, is much, much more difficult than many people think.
Again, I'm speaking with Aziz Haque, who's a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He is a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg, of course, champion of women's rights, has said about Roe v. Wade that it's not that the judgment was wrong, but it moved too far too fast. And she also suggested that the Supreme Court in 1973 should have struck down only the restrictive Texas abortion law before it broadened it out into the ruling it became. So give us a sense of what your former boss is trying to tell us there.
Right. So she is making a point about the speed with which social change happens. And she's not making a point about whether it ought to be the courts as opposed to a legislature that brings social change, nor is she arguing with the fundamental legal principle at issue in Roe v. Wade. I think the way that she would have approached it had she been the lawyer for Roe in that case, and obviously she was litigating a sequence of cases about gender equality at the same time that Roe was decided in the early 70s. What I think that she's saying she would have preferred is to seek a narrower ruling that applied only to the specific law at hand, and then to build upon that narrow ruling over time in ways that made the court's ruling seem more incremental, more careful, and therefore more thoughtful and justified. And it's certainly plausible that kind of approach would have led to less public backlash. But with all due respect to my former boss, who I think is right about almost everything, I'm not certain that's the case. I think there's lots of instances that one can think of in which particularly reactionary movements see any small concession to the other side. So the idea that, you know, in a textbook in Arizona that you would teach something about the history of migration of Latinos to the United States, they see that little thing as a sign that, oh gosh, we're about to balkanize the races in Arizona, and, you know, this is the beginning of a new form of segregation or a Latino power movement or something. So the people all the time perceive even small changes as the nose of the camel in the tent, the beginning of the slippery slope or what have you. And we often see dramatic political conflict over things that are in essence symbolic. Right, on these sort of issues, we've seen this with respect to funding for public health work overseas. Think about the conflicts over federally funded art, things like Andrea Serrano's painting. So I'm not sure that even had the Supreme Court moved slower and issued a narrower ruling, I'm not sure that somebody like Phyllis Schlafly couldn't have turned around and said, hey, this is an opportunity for us to mobilize our base and really go out and say the Supreme Court's about to wreck American womanhood. And I don't think that somebody like Phyllis Schlafly cares enough about the precise meets and bounds of the Supreme Court's opinion to really change their behavior if the court moves slower rather than faster.
So, Aziz Haq, of course, it's a different world today from 1973 with a younger generation that's sort of post-sexual and post-racial, and the environment is quite different. The social environment is quite different.
Yeah.
What do you think is, though, in terms of overturning Prop 8? You suggested that there are a number of options that the Supreme Court has.
That's right. So I'll give you three different approaches. So the first approach is that the court could say what California did in granting and then rolling back same-sex marriage was not allowed. And they would focus upon the rolling back of a right that's been given where there was no evidence that that right had any kind of harmful side effects. Right? That would be a very narrow ruling because it would only apply to the facts of California. The second ruling, which would be slightly larger, I believe it would encompass either 8 or 9 states, would say, well, if you're a state and you allow for civil unions, but you don't allow for marriage, and the only difference between those two things is the label marriage, then you don't have a good reason to withhold that label. There's no permissible reason that you have for saying X is a civil union and Y is a marriage, and therefore, if you as a state have civil union, you have to allow for same-sex marriage. That would affect 8 or 9 states. It's a slightly broader ruling. It applies across, obviously, to a larger geographic area. And then the broadest ruling of all is to say that the Equal Protection Clause applies to people of different sexualities in a way that makes it illegal for any governmental unit, be it a state or the federal government, to deny a benefit such as marriage on the basis of sexual preferences. And that would be an extremely broad ruling. It would require every state in the country to, in essence, turn around and install same-sex marriage. If you were to think about the application of the sort of the Ginsbergian concern in this case, right, it's the idea that if you turn around in June when the case is handed down and say, right, Alabama, you have to allow for same-sex marriage, it's requiring an awful lot of transition in a very short time. And that transition might itself have costs in ways that spark political opposition. So, and whereas the first two options are picking out in some fashion those states in which there's already a substantial constituency for marriage equality and saying, yeah, you move forward and you do this, but it's very hard to see how that legal principle can over time be cabined to just those states. So I think even if the Supreme Court just opens the door here, it's very hard to see how over time the court doesn't have to step through the door.
So Aziz Haq, the other case, of course, the Defense of Marriage Act that's before the Supreme Court, the person who signed that, President Clinton, has disavowed it. And his wife, of course, has come out in favor of same-sex marriage, which would, I think, is a kind of indication that she's running for president, frankly. What is its fate, do you think?
Right. So the difference, just so your listeners understand, between the California case and the Defense of Marriage Act case is that in the California case, what's at issue is whether a state can grant or deny marriage licenses to people of the same biological sex. The Defense of Marriage Act, by contrast, is, as you alluded to, a federal statute that regulates when and how the federal government can recognize a marriage that is entered into under state law. Right, and this matters for benefits, for tax purposes, for inheritance purposes, matters for all sorts of things. Immigration, it's a really big deal. And the Defense of Marriage Act was signed by President Clinton at a time when no states recognized same-sex marriage. And so when he signed it, it had no practical effect because there were no states issuing marriage licenses to same-sex couples. Now, obviously, today that's very different. And today, as a consequence of the Defense of Marriage Act, there are many states in which if you, as a same-sex couple, get a license to marry, and then you move across state lines, another state may not recognize that license, right? So that's that, and the federal government categorically will not. So if you're in one of the cases, there's people who were spouses worked for the federal government, and they didn't get benefits as they should have, right? Or in my view, as they should have. And what's at issue in the DOMA case is whether the federal government's decision to distinguish between valid state marriage licenses, depending upon whether it's a same-sex or opposite-sex couple, is lawful. And that's a much easier case for the court to decide, because the federal government, under President Obama, has said they think that the law is unconstitutional. It's relatively easy for the federal government to change its practices with respect to the definition of marriage. All it does is it has to say, okay, if there's a state that requires, that allows for same-sex marriages, we will now start to recognize those same-sex marriages. So it's a much easier and much lower stakes case to decide. There are also kind of technical legal reasons why a decision in favor of the plaintiffs in the DOMA case, striking down the law, doesn't necessarily lead to a ruling for gay marriage. You can acoustically separate them by kind of technical legal doctrinal reasons.
So just in closing then, Aziz Haq, in terms of handicapping the justices, I think you can safely say that Thomas and Scalia and Alito will probably vote against repealing DOMA and overturning Prop 8. But what about Kennedy and the Chief Justice? He seems to be, at least in the landmark Obamacare case, he seems to be indicating a certain independence.
We could differ over the Chief Justice Roberts and the landmark case. Yeah. But I think that they're very hard to read. The two things that I think are relevant to that question are, first, in the DOMA case, there is a states' rights issue. And insofar as there are states that are issuing marriage licenses, you know, Massachusetts, et cetera, and the federal government isn't recognizing those. And so it's in a sense, slighting the state. And so that kind of federalism, states' rights gloss, I think, is going to appeal to Kennedy. And it might make him sympathetic with respect to that case in particular. The second thing that's important to know is that there is, I think, a pretty powerful argument that the court ought to dismiss the California marriage case because it isn't within the jurisdiction of the federal courts under a fairly technical set of rules called standing. And the fact that there is that, what some might characterize as an out, right, because it just means the court can say, we don't need to rule on this, we're going to dismiss it, come back another day, give another 4 or 5 years, maybe the world will be different. You've got to factor that into your predictions about what the different justices are going to do.
Well, Aziz Haq, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Aziz Haq, who's a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk at the Supreme Court for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced, Presidential Power at a Time of Terror. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the growing split in the Republican Party.
Ooh, love breaks the machine.